Marcus, your book, Maybe the Saddest Thing, published in October 2012 by HarperCollins, was selected by D.A. Powell for the National Poetry Series. It would be great if you would tell us about the book and maybe read a couple of poems from it.
Well, the book started when I was in grad school. It began as my MFA thesis, and then I carried it over to the Fine Arts Work Center and worked out some revisions. But really, a central speaker is talking to several people. He's talking to these sort of black pop cultural icons. Think Flavor Flav, think RuPaul, Justin Timberlake. He's also asking these questions about the difference between love and lust, other things. These questions sort of repeat in a cycle, and just when he thinks he's figured out an answer, they start again. So maybe the saddest thing is sort of the cyclical nature of the thought process that regulates the book. I'd be happy to read a couple for you.
Great.
I will read you Love Letter to Flavor Flav. And it begins with an epigraph from Langston Hughes. We know we are beautiful and ugly too. I think I love you. How you suck fried chicken grease off chalkboard fingers in public, or walk the runway down an escalator with a clock around your neck. How you rapped about the poor with a gold tooth grin. How your gold teeth spell your name. How you love your name is beautiful. You shout your name 100 times each day. They say, if you repeat something enough, you can become it. I'd like to know, does Flavor Flav sound ugly to you? I think it's slightly beautiful. I bet you love mirrors. Tell the truth. When you find plastic Viking horns or clown shades staring back, is it beauty you see or vaudeville? To express myself honestly enough, that, my friend, is very hard to do. Those are Bruce Lee's words. I mention Bruce Lee here only because you remind me of him. That's a lie. But your shades do mirror a mask he wore as Green Hornet's trusty sidekick. No, I'm not calling names. Chuck D would have set cities on fire had you let him. You are not Public Enemy's sidekick. You hose down whole crowds and loud mouth flame retardant spit. You did this only by repeating your name. I think I love you. I think I really might mean it this time. William. Can I call you William? I should have asked 27 lines ago. What have you become? How you've lived, saying nothing save the same words each day, is a kind of freedom or beauty. Please, tell me I'm not lying to us.
You know, Marcus, I don't know Flavor Flav.
Okay. He was the hype man for Public Enemy, a sort of radical, socially progressive hip-hop group in the 80s, primarily. And whereas Chuck D, the front man, was uber political and sometimes scared people off, Flavor Flav was goofy. He was sort of a clown. But in order to get that message across, they sort of needed someone to play that role in order for people to take him seriously. These days, he had a reality show called Flavor of Love. He's done some sort of silly commercials, and people have forgotten his weight. And so I thought, you know, writing a sort of ode to him where I poked fun but took him seriously would sort of get one back, take one back for the team.
Neat.
Sure, let me read that. Love letter to RuPaul. You have one of the longest, thickest, most vain, colossal set of hands that I have ever seen, and frankly, they cast a spell on me. Not that I'm the type of man who goes around checking out other men's hands, but I know tightly tucked cuticles when I see them. Even sexier is the hourglass-shaping chokehold you can put on a mic. You could hurl a 2-foot monkey wrench at a mirror, or pull out and push in a date's chair with the flick of a wrist. I bet you don't, though. Bet you've never carried a man up 4 flights of stairs, limp arms flailing every which way. And if you have, I bet you took care to cradle his neck, to avoid banisters and to walk slowly, because you are fierce in the way only a 6'7" black drag queen could be. And one of my earliest memories, you were wearing a pink sequin dress, endorsing a hamburger, good enough for a man, maybe a woman. I am a black man who has never worn pink. Not a polo to a country club, not gaiters to a church, and still, that commercial ravished me. How hard to be sandwiched between what and who you are, tickled by every cruel wind, critic voyeur playing rough beneath your skirt. How raw you must be to sit before a camera, legs uncrossed.
Where did that come from? I know who RuPaul is, and occasionally watch the Drag Race.
Sort of the same thing as Flavor Flav. I was watching a commercial for the Drag Race, and also actually reading an essay by Susan Bordeaux called "Beauty Rediscovers the Male Body." This sort of essay about queer theory and about advertising. And I saw this this picture as RuPaul, dressed in, you know, a very sleek Calvin Klein suit with this sort of pimp cane, and I thought, here's a different image. Here's a way that I'm not used to seeing RuPaul. Just let me try and put that image in a poem. And then I started thinking about his lifestyle and the commercials that he's been in, his public image, and I thought, well, what about his private image? And the poem just sort of took it on its own life from there.
In your writing practice, another author coming to read in the MSU series, Claire Vey Watkins, said that the best part comes when a mystery occurs and you follow it during the writing process. It sounds like you're excited by the same possibilities.
Oh, she's smart. That's exactly right. You know, for me, sometimes poetry is like figuring out a math equation, solving for X. Sometimes I don't know what's on my mind or what's on my heart until I sit down and it just comes out of me. And it's the best way for me to solve things. Let's see. I'll give you a little context. I was in Bloomington, Indiana. I went to Indiana University. I did my MFA there. And, oh, I must have been 25 or so at the time. I'd never been on public transportation before. Never been on the bus. And I just got really excited about riding the bus every day, and I wanted to write this manuscript called The Bus Driver Chronicles about all these crazy bus drivers that I'd met, but it turns out the poems were bad. But one day, I was on this bus, and there was this woman, her two little girls, it was in the winter, she didn't have enough fare to get them both on the bus. And I was on this campus shuttle with other students who had their iPods and their laptops, and I probably had money in my pocket. Didn't give her money, none of us did, but what I did was take really good notes for my next poem. And so months later, I started to think, in observing the world for my poetry, have I forgotten how to live in it? And that's where this poem starts. It's called, "I'm a Sad, Sad Man. So sad, I can't remember how to ride a bus right. Just the other day, I forgot who I was and couldn't budge to help a human in need because the pen in my pocket was poking my thigh saying, use me, use them, write their stories. As if I am not them, that woman and her two little girls, mounting some 10-ton thing daily, fare or no fare, rust bucket but not broken down, traveling at a pace beyond my control. And how sad it is, because I'm really not them. Most days, I keep at least a buck in my pocket to pay the driver, and if not, a briefcase which says, I'm good for it. That was somehow miserable to admit. I'm only telling you this because you're reading a poem, probably spend perfectly good bar nights feeling the world deeply with the ballpoint pen in your pocket. And though a tad abnormal to discuss, all humans want to understand everything and for everyone to understand us. What I can't understand is what makes me see differently any three people on a bus. Maybe the saddest thing in the world is not knowing how to feel cold, plastic bus seats without thinking of narrative arc. The 10,000 pains shifting uncomfortably from cheek to raw red cheek, and in any given moment, this.
Wow. You've really hit on a topic that is pertinent to the field of any media. I feel sometimes when a great disaster strikes and the television crews are pointing their cameras at people fighting over water, I just want to sort of shake them and say, you know, put down the cameras and help them distribute the water.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
How did you become a poet?
Accidentally, honestly. When I was in high school, I had a really great English teacher, and she took us to the National Youth Poetry Slam. It was the first year that it was held in Ann Arbor. Now it's called Brave New Voices, and HBO has done this special on it. But at the time, I saw these kids who were, you know, 14, 15, about the same age as me, and I'd been writing things in my journal, and I wasn't quite sure what to call them, but they were performing these things and being very fearless, and I thought, you know, if they can do it, I can do it too. And so I met another teacher at this crosstown high school who ran this poetry slam team, and that's the way that I got my start. I started performing. Went to college, and I was a public law major with an English writing minor. So I had a few creative writing courses, but they were usually with grad students. And I was headed to law school. I had got in, was headed there, filled out the FAFSA information, and at the last minute I decided, you know, law school is sink or swim. Either you want it or you don't. And at that point, I probably wanted it more for my mother. So I took a year off, and I got this job in marketing at this architecture firm. I wrote this ad copy and proposals, and it was fine. But the whole time before I graduated, I'd been writing these poems in my constitutional law book. So I kept writing the poems as I was marketing. And after a while, I thought, the architects are pedantic. I need to go back to school. I can't do this. And so on a whim, I applied to several schools. I got in contact with some of those graduate students. They wrote me letters of rec, and I just sort of took a chance.
It sounds like the saga of an English major.
That's right. That's what I tell my students sometimes. Maybe you'll use your degree, maybe you won't. But it's productive, you know. English teaches you to think critically, and I thought my way through to this poetry degree, really.
And what does your mother think?
Oh, she's so proud now. She would never even admit that she wanted me to do something else. When I mention it, she doesn't remember. She's got selective amnesia about it.
What are you working on now?
Tentatively, I call this collection, this thing I'm working on, Cul-de-Sac Pastoral. I'm writing about suburbia, praise poems to the hermetically sealed lawn, and the house that you pick out from a magazine, sort of tongue-in-cheek, poking fun at them, but also exploring the complexities of, you know, living next to people a few feet away that you don't really know, and things looking lush but being built really quickly. And I'm having fun, you know, I'm just having fun writing these poems.
How does teaching affect your writing practice?
Well, I mean, certainly when you teach something, you have to know it better than if you're just reading, for instance. If I'm reading Dorian Lux on a Sunday, I'm not reading probably as critical as I would if I'm thinking about presenting it to a class. So that alone helps me think about poetry, its machinery, its logic, deeper. But then also, my students are really smart. I find myself stealing from them, stealing their ideas, stealing their lines sometimes. They're inspirational. Sometimes I don't even know it.
What will you share some of your new poetry when you read at Murray State?
I will, absolutely.
Excellent. Thank you for speaking with me today.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for asking.